eve of the Harold Brown trip, I think you were in Washington and making some rounds.
Right. I talked about being out at Langley. I think that I had been strongly suggested to me by Dick Holbrook I should try and find out if they were, if they had done anything about listening posts in China. Of course, I didn't find out anything. And made the usual rounds, met with General Signius, who was then in charge of arms control and disarmament agency, the INR, and the other intelligence people, Lester Wolf and his staff. I went over, didn't I, the meetings with Vice President Mondale and the political situation, yes. Had a session, I think it was at my instigation, with Congressman Zablocki, the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee. Met with commerce people and the NSA people. And then returned to, left for China on December 26th, and arrived in Japan on the 27th, which of course was the same day that Soviets moved into Afghanistan, and got back to China on December 28th. And that night, had to go to a concert because Seiji Ozawa was conducting the Beijing Philharmonic, and mass choral groups from the PLA and other institutions around Peking, and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It was really quite a performance. I was glad that's all there was on the program, because both of us were mighty sleepy. Then on the 29th September, I note that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry of Culture gave their annual New Year's reception in a film for the foreign community. At that time, I discussed Iran and the hostage situation with Jiang Wenjin for the first time, and got a very affirmative response, in the sense this was a gross violation of international law, intolerable, and had to be corrected. The issue was then coming up before the Security Council. And on Sunday the 30th, and as you know, meetings at the Foreign Ministry on a Sunday were quite unusual. In the afternoon, I met with Jiang Wenjin again on the question of the issue in the Security Council and China's position. And that issue was the condemning Iran for the violation of international law, and the giving them a date by which to release the hostages. As I remember, the resolution also said if that were not done by that date, then sanctions would be called for. met with him again. This was at 3:45 on Sunday the 30th. I met with him again at 10:30 on Monday morning on the same question. I think it was at that time that I was informed that China would act affirmatively on that resolution, which they did. I had no more meetings with Jiang Wen-jen or anyone else on that question prior to the arrival of Secretary Brown. We did have a dinner at the residence to celebrate the first anniversary of normalization, to which Wang Hua came and Jiang Wen-jen and others. There was a total of 22 of us from the Chinese side and the American side, and that was held on the evening of Thursday, January the 3rd. And then it was on Saturday, January the 5th, that the Brown Party arrived. And at 9:45 that night, he and I had a session in the conference room, at which time I first heard about that the Chinese would be told the American change of policy to be willing to sell them civilian items, high technology rating with dual use, which could be converted to military purposes, and the willingness to sell military equipment, which was not designated in the discussion as non-lethal. That sort of came out as the meetings unfolded. I had a brief session, just the two of us, and then there was a larger session with the whole party and with additional people from the embassy.
Did that decision take you by surprise?
Wait a minute. It wasn't that. That was the next morning, Sunday morning. Yes, I was quite surprised because, of course, I'd been back and had been involved to some degree, not to a major degree, but at least informed as to what was anticipated for the discussions. And these things were not in the picture, obviously, brought about by the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan on the 27th.
That's right. In fact, it was a decision made on the morning of Harold Brown's departure. I believe he left on the 4th. That would have been correct, with the crossing the international dateline.
Right.
He wheels up at about 10 a.m. on the morning of the 4th, and he had had a meeting with Dr. Brzezinski, with the President, Secretary Vance. That particular item was added to his agenda. It grew out of a rather feverish weekend of activity following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Hardly anyone was in town, as I recall. I was not there. Most staffers of the NSC were away. I believe some of the principal decision makers were also on vacation. This was, of course, the weekend of the Michigan Rose Bowl victory over the University of Washington. And I would be damned if I was going to go back to Washington. But in any case, I got a phone call saying, what would I add to a list of things to do? What are the range of activities that one could do to further indicate U.S. displeasure with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan? What could we do to create different balances? And I believe that I put this one up, but Zbig had thought of it long before, obviously, as a possibility, and it was a part of a very long shopping list of actions, not all of which were obviously China-related. Most of the actions were not China-related.
So, as I say, that my meeting with Secretary Brown was at 9:45 on the Sunday morning rather than the Monday night. In fact, they didn't even arrive on the Saturday night, I mean, until 9:10. Went directly to the guest house, number 4.
He even stepped off the plane, you remember, with a press statement that he wanted to get on TV about the consultations that he had hoped would result from this visit. And we clued the journalists in on the plane trip that Brown would have a especially warm welcome for the Chinese military officials present to greet him. It was all very stage managed.
Now that Saturday night, he met Minister of Defense Xu. That must have been at the guest house.
Guest house, but
because he was in very poor health.
That's right. But who was it? Geng Biao. Wu Shouchuan greeted him at the airport.
Right.
And he gave him a very warm handshake, I remember, and then went on for some minutes of time because he wanted that picture of him shaking hands with the Chinese general.
Right. Then on the Sunday at 4 o'clock, along with Dick Holbrooke, Secretary Holbrooke, we met with Zhang Wenjin, and that, of course, would be, I'm sure, on the continuing Iranian problem. And that night, the night of Sunday the 6th, there was a welcoming banquet at the Great Hall for Secretary Brown, and we had a pre-dinner meeting with Defense Minister Xu in a small hall near the banquet room, because the defense minister was not only advanced in years, but in very bad health, was not going to be in any of the formal meetings. But you were there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You remember, he kept on talking. The Chinese were trying to, in effect, shut him up. But I guess he didn't get much chance to talk to foreigners, certainly. And he kept going, so that the dinner was somewhat delayed.
Well, it was, I thought, not just his age, but he was already, it was well thought, it was that he was already to have left the Ministry of Defense by that time, but there were signs of considerable disagreement among the top leaders as to who would take Minister of Defense Xu's place.
Right.
You will recall that there had been rumors that Geng Biao was to become the Minister of Defense, but then
following
he had
the May visit to the U.S.
Well, no, even before that,
that was still in advance,
but
right.
Even at this point, there were discussions, and at one point, I believe he was accused of corruption and favoritism for his children. It was thought that he had some connections with bank deposits even in Hong Kong.
Well, his daughter used to appear in Hong Kong very frequently, right, and talked extremely freely and too much.
That's right. So that was used against him, and there was so Xu was already on his way out, but there was no real replacement. No person had been named. Your date book may not show this, and I just don't remember whether you were even involved, but did you attend the private session on Sunday that Harold Brown had with Gung Biao?
No.
He went with, I guess not, I think it was Mike Armacost and myself to discuss how to handle the sensitive issue, because we did not wish a repetition,
right,
of the Deng Xiaoping business. So we requested a private audience with Gung Biao, and he expressed his awareness of progress in that particular area, and then requested that there be no reference to it in public remarks, and indicated that if there were any private matters to be discussed, he would be prepared to listen to the Chinese. And we went over to the Great Hall of the People on Sunday, mid-afternoon, I believe, for
right,
that session. But
I
you
was
were aware of it.
I was aware of the meeting.
That's right.
Right. But it was in the afternoon. And on the Monday, we went back for the formal meeting at 9 o'clock with Gung Biao at the Great Hall. What is your memory of that meeting?
It was a general survey of world affairs and the strategic balance, as I recall, and each side made a presentation, and the Chinese made a surprisingly lengthy one, and I thought one of the more interesting and balanced presentations. Gung is no great heavyweight intellectually, but, and as I recall, he was one of the few times where they read from a statement, but his policy posture was quite extensive. Is that what you recall?
Yes. And then we went back to the guest house for a meeting of the secretary with Foreign Minister Wang Hua, which preceded lunch that was held at 2 o'clock. And my memory is that this, to some degree, covered the same ground, didn't it?
That's right, but also that is where I believe, and you remember I was incorrect in my earlier recollection of Mondale's lunch. This was the lunch where the Vietnam situation was discussed, but also at great length the UN vote was discussed. And Brown really hammered home, he was under instructions to really hammer home.
Now, I think by this time, the initial vote had been taken in the Security Council, and China voted with us. And the deadline date was approaching, at which point there was a second vote was now looming before us.
That's right.
And that was the vote to implement the sanctions. In fact, the Security Council of the UN would be calling on the nations to implement sanctions against Iran. And this is where the Chinese were saying to us, we are completely in support. We're repeating all the gross violation of international law, but there are also practical considerations to be taken into account, how far you can push Iran without pushing them into the arms of the Soviet Union, to an even greater danger. That was discussed with the foreign minister,
that's right,
and the secretary of defense. Did pursue it pretty vigorously. And And then we went back, or rather, Gung Biao then came out to the guest house to resume the talks that had been held that morning in the Great Hall, and that was done at 4 o'clock. It lasted for some two and a half hours, as I remember it.
I do not recall whether it was during the first or the second session in which Secretary Brown outlined the change in American policy toward the sale of military equipment. Do you recall?
I think it was in the first session.
That's my vague recollection.
And then we came back to it in the second session.
That's my vague
recollection.
That's right.
To answer Chinese questions. And then that night on the 7th, there was entertainment by the Beijing Opera. Then on the morning, at 8:30 on the morning of Tuesday the 8th, I was asked to go over to another guest house to meet with the Egyptian Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs, Dr. Osama El-Baz, at guest house number 18, so it was on the other side of the complex. And what he wanted was Chinese permission to overfly Korea. And because of the sensitivity of the Egyptian connection, I was urged to do all I could to bring that about. As you know, I didn't get very far with the question at that time and had to go back and tell him that my mission had been unsuccessful. Then that morning, Tuesday morning, the secretary met for over 2 hours with Deng Xiaoping at the Great Hall. Which the new policy matters were gone over. And my memory of it was that, not skepticism, but curiosity as to just what this meant.
Curiosity and a certain amount of reserve, I think. I might use that word.
That's a better word. Yes. I think my impression of the discussions on both the Monday and the Tuesday was that they didn't understand what this meant in practical terms.
Well, I would say something else. That you're quite right. It goes to the China. Let us digress for a minute about Chinese negotiating style and Chinese diplomatic style. I think diplomatic style is perhaps a better word. I believe the Chinese approach meetings with the view that a great deal of preparation should go on beforehand, and that there be a minimum of surprises in the course of the dialogue.
That's a good point.
That is to say that the proposals that each side was to put forward would not actually be made at the visit or during the visit itself. Rather, the proposals were to have been communicated beforehand with some explanation. Now, if one thinks through all the visits that you and I have remembered in the course of these interviews, in each one, the United States had borne the major burden in making proposals. But we had carefully communicated those proposals through you well in advance. In Mondale's trip, every point that Mondale was going to raise had already been communicated to the Chinese, both in Washington and in Peking. With the Brown trip, a number of the proposals had been raised. For example, we proposed, if you recall, some kind of a hotline between Peking and Washington. We also proposed, once again, but stopped touching on it lightly, ship visits. We touched on a couple other proposals we had for enhancing military cooperation between our two countries, such as exchange of visits. But lo and behold, within 24 hours of coming, the Brown visit, and this is more a retrospective construction on my part, the Brown visit suddenly starts hitting the Chinese on the Iran issue, when we had not done much communication to indicate to them that that would be an important part of Brown's agenda. And we hit them with a range of initiatives as far as Afghanistan is concerned. Not only did we indicate that we were prepared to sell non-lethal military equipment and relax our policy on sale of dual-purpose technologies, but we also requested overflights for swift delivery of supplies to Pakistan, and we referred to the difficult situation that the Afghan freedom fighters soon would find themselves in, and made some suggestions about the weapon systems that would be particularly useful. We inquired about particular SAM equipment that we thought the Chinese manufactured. We also asked about shoulder-carried anti-aircraft missiles, particularly, I guess, against helicopters. Well, this is a far departure from what I would say is careful diplomacy, and I think it left the Chinese somewhat bewildered and trying to figure out what our purpose was and whether we were trying to quickly drag them in to a range of activities for which they had been given insufficient warning from their perspective, which had great consequence for them, and which could involve them in relations with the Soviet Union that are really not favorable to them. I don't know whether you agree with that.
Oh, I think that's very, very much on the mark. Because they were very reserved through it all. They were not hostile. What was the name of the man, the military man who headed up subsequently their advance team before the Gung Biao visit?
I don't remember.
The vice chief of staff.
I don't remember his name.
I remember in the first relaxed reaction, we were sitting around waiting for a subcommittee meeting, and he said, well, as he personally understood the new American policy, Americans were ready to sell the Chinese the very latest in communications equipment, but no arms, so that their men, being unable to defend themselves, would know more quickly when to get out of a given situation. I suppose, too, that must have been puzzling to them. But here we were saying, now, things that are non-lethal, we're willing to let you have the very latest technology. We're talking about the over-the-horizon radar. And I remember we were quite disappointed, I think, on our side, when the Chinese didn't rush at that possibility with open arms. Instead, we're, as you say, very reserved. That's an excellent word for their whole attitude. I now see for what person I was asking the overflight possibility. It was the Vice President Mubarak, because at 6 o'clock I went to the Egyptian embassy for the reception they were giving for the Vice President and Mrs. Mubarak. I wonder, thinking back of the Chinese, knowing what was to come, would have tried to do something about that.
So he was the person who was there at the time.
He was there on a visit, yes.
A visit that took him to Japan as well, is that right?
I think so. Yes, I think so.
I believe that Secretary Brown called on him during the visit, too. That they had known each other.
Yes, yeah. That was done out of the guest house.
Right.
Then that night, we had a meeting, a small meeting. On the Chinese side, it was just military, headed by Chiang Kai-ping. You were in that meeting?
Yes.
And I was so upset by that meeting, because if you remember, the secretary was patiently explaining what our proposals amount to. And John kept waving his hands every once in a while and said, "This is very simple. Either give us the weapons or give us the blueprints. There's nothing to talk about. Why waste all these words?" I think he did that three times. And then there was as we went in, I think the third man sitting on there in their delegation, who had a military uniform, and this was a man who had been at Caltech. In the days before Brown was president of Caltech, but who had been at Caltech,
Chen.
I think, on the faculty for some time.
The rocket expert named Chen.
That was he.
Yes.
And Brown had expressed an interest in meeting with him. And Zhang, in effect, said, "Well, here he is. You asked to meet him, here he is." And he feigned to have difficulty understanding English. It was really quite humiliating. And we were told, by whom? This was the first time he had appeared at any kind of a meeting in a military uniform. He had always appeared before in civilian clothes. And so my unhappiness with the meeting, I think, was started by that. Zhang as well. Here he is. His almost contemptuous attitude. And I remember after the meeting broke up, and the secretary was endlessly patient. He was really remarkable that night. I was walking out behind him, and I said, "God, how can you stand this shit?" And he said, "It's good training for a congressional committee." But the strange thing was that Chiang Kai-ping subsequently was at the residence just on the eve of the National People's Congress that made him a vice premier. And he was charming and relaxed and friendly.
Oh, really?
Because when I'd heard he was going to be one of the new vice premiers, I didn't think this was very much of a plus for the U.S. And I forget what the occasion was, but he was there, and as I say, he was as friendly as could be, and very relaxed. When I congratulated him, his answer was, "It hasn't happened yet. Anything can happen." I think it was two days before, it was very close. But
well, he, to identify him for the sake of the record, he was at the time, the head of the National Defense Science and Technology Commission. He therefore, at least nominally, was the military equivalent of Vice Premier Fang Yi. This was a man who was in charge,
right,
of all of the research and development for China's national defense. My recollection of that evening is very similar to yours. I thought that we were in the hands of a guerrilla warrior, of limited intellectual means. I thought we were in the hands of somewhat of almost a boxer rebellion mentality.
Right.
Namely, that if the Chinese were armed with the right thought, they would overcome all resistance.
Including reading the blueprints.
That's right. And that he had exhibited no understanding of the scientific process. It struck me as just the kind of person who has been an obstacle to China's quest for modernity.
Exactly.
It was an unbelievable evening. It was not just that he kept saying, just give us the blueprints, but it was clear that he could not absorb.
He didn't want to listen.
Yeah. Didn't want to listen, but also that he didn't want to listen out of a combination of arrogance and an inability to understand what was being said. And one despairs, but I'm delighted that you had another session with him that suggests that perhaps there are more parts to the man than we witnessed.
So, thinking of the second Jiang Gaiping that I met, I know that late that night and the next morning I felt very low in my estimate of the future as to what would be the relationship between our country and China. Because here was this man who was this contemptuous treatment of this colleague who had done so much for the Chinese defense, who had come back to China of his own volition, bringing his great scientific knowledge. And it was almost as though they were exhibiting something on a pin.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's being so rude, not wanting to listen and keep interrupting. Oh, stop these words. Either give us the weapons or give us the blueprints. It was the whole atmosphere of the meeting was really very bad.
But again, that seems to me to demonstrate the point I was making earlier, and it's an important point in thinking about Chinese diplomatic practice. There are some very obtuse individuals at the head of that political system, and the only route to eliciting understanding is to feed information in at the lower levels of the bureaucracy and hope that the Han Shu types and the Zhang Wenjin types can prepare for a meeting by developing briefing papers so that the individual can begin to grasp the issues at stake. After all, Harold Brown was trying to convey in that particular session a person who is not at all acquainted with technology, be a very subtle point. What is the difference between dual-purpose technology and military equipment? And that is a subtle point which I don't think I ever learned during my time in Washington. It's elusive. And you can't really expect someone 72, 73 years of age of peasant background to walk in and sit down and have someone of Harold Brown's sophistication, you know, explain the discrepancy between dual-purpose technology and military equipment and bring that person along in a course of 1 or 2 hours. And the person is bound to react in a defensive, nativistic way, arrogantly or whatever. But I agree with you too. That was one of the most memorable sessions I had in China because it encapsulated the problems of China's modernization, the tension between the nativists and those who have been abroad, what the nativists do when they're cornered. Dramatic evening from that point of view.
It's interesting to note that when recently they reduced the number of vice premiers from 13 to 2, was it 13? But put the bulk of the 11 on the State Council, is it?
That's right, Standing Committee.
One of the two who was not so handled was Chiang Kai-ping.
That's right.
His age, possibly, whatever, because by this time he's 75.
On the other hand, if you remember at that same session, there was Wu Shouchuan, also an old party person, the head of their intelligence section, deputy chief of staff. He had no trouble understanding what was being said.
Right.
And so some of the Chinese military figures had succeeded in achieving the intellectual journey from a semi-Neolithic peasant village in which they grew up to nuclear war, and others hadn't. Wu had. Wu was just a terribly impressive guy.
Yes. Then the next morning, Wednesday the 9th, I see that I meet with Brock Adams. Now, by this time, he was out of the cabinet, of course. Those cabinet changes were...
He lost out in the summer of 79.
He was there as an attorney advisory to Port of Portland, I think.
Seattle.
And they had come up with the developed the approach, which had been explained to me by Warren Magnuson when I'd been back in the United States. The Chinese shipping could come to the United States even without an agreement, as long as it... now that we had normalization, as long as it was designated as government property, and there was a certificate to that effect, it was then that would be proof against seizure. And I remember we'd had considerable difficulty getting Chinese overseas shipping to get the subtlety of that point, because they were the government. Why are we asking them to say that this ship is the property of the government of the People's Republic of China? The fact that it was the property of China overseas shipping, doesn't that speak for itself? And by this time, I think that the Chinese had accepted the approach, and Brock was there with... a representative of the shipping line, I think, that was in... No, it must
Light's
have been
shipping line, too. He was representing Light's at some point. Are you sure, though, that problem of security of Chinese property was still at issue in early 1980?
It was from private suit.
Uh-huh. I thought that had already been settled with
the
claims
agreement.
Asset.
We didn't have a maritime agreement
the
at this point.
Maritime agreement. I see.
Then we went out to the 6th Armored Division to see the tanks go through their paces. And it isn't until one sees that one realizes how backward the Chinese military is. How those tanks would have to come to an absolute stop before they could fire. Then you remember they put on for us the motorcyclist's performance. But then we went to their headquarters for lunch.
Great lunch.
Oh, the Mao Tai flowed like water. And I remember that commander, young, vigorous, such a contrast to the night before. And the warmth, there was a warm relationship began to develop between Chinese and American military.
One could understand how